My name is Emily White. I'm from Minneapolis. This is the first session of five on inner journeys, and I will be talking about dreams in the third session. I will be talking about the psychology of Carl Jung tomorrow, and today I want to give an introduction based on Parker Palmer's book, The Promise of Paradox. And as you know, the other book that is in the bookstore is Dreams, A Way to Listen to God. And if you want to have some introduction to it, read it. It's a small book, this big. And I will not be following it exactly, but it's basically what this whole series is about. And I have written up on the board the verse from 2 Corinthians, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. And that's kind of the theme of today's talk. The treasure is the soul, that part of you that doesn't die. The earthen vessel is that part of us that we take so much care of that keeps us going, but that unfortunately as we grow older deteriorates a bit. However, we have the promise in Corinthians also that though the outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed every day. I'd like to repeat that. Though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed every day. So that's rather hopeful, I think, as we grow older. The paradox pervades everything that Jesus said. Paradox pervades our lives. Paradox is what seems to be at the core of the cross. The very cross is a paradox. The arms extended horizontally and to heaven and to earth. How reconcile? Parker Palmer talks about several aspects of this need for reconciliation. But before we get into it, I want to give a few examples of paradox in our daily life right here at Holden. And every morning I walk up to Railroad Creek, and I've been here many summers, and I look at the water and I say, well, it's not the same water, but it's the same creek. Our theme, gentle justice, is a paradox. I always think of justice as being, you know, very stern. But we're called to do gentle justice. Body and soul, I've hinted at that before. And if any of you have some paradox examples, I'd like you to share them. Anyone? What paradox strikes you?
I'm a single person.
Say that again?
Tough love.
Tough love. Thank you. That's a very good one. We often think of love as being soft, just as we often think of Jesus being always soft and mild, but he could be very stern and express his righteous anger. And most of his parables are paradoxes. And the concept of tough love is the best way to raise your adolescents. And I have four, so I don't know if I've always been tough enough, but it's a good one. Thank you. Anyone else?
Grace.
Costly Grace, Bonhoeffer. Thank you. Yes. And as you read the parables and you read your Bible, you will find that paradox pervades the Bible. The inner journeys that I'm talking about are not something we pay attention to most of the time. I'm a psychologist and I have listened to people's problems, and often in the darkest time, a new light breaks through. But you have to sort of reach the pit before you even see a way out. And when you are in a conflict situation, you're torn here and you're torn there, and you say, well, shall I do this or shall I do that? And usually the solution is neither this nor that, but a third way that resolves both one pole and the other, or both one situation and another. The resolution of a conflict is usually not necessarily compromise, but a transformation. We'll come to that towards the end of the week. We'll talk about how dreams can transform a lot of energy that has been stuffed down. Another thing I have found in doing therapy is that people come in depressed and see only the dark side. It's a corollary to just what I said. They see the darkness, they see no way out, they're perplexed, depressed, and the light seems to almost have gone out, and I have to reassure them that the light, the inner light that the Quakers talk about, is still there, and that all we have to do is get rid of the garbage they threw down, you see? So sometimes I call myself the garbologist. Are you ready to go on the journey? Parker Palmer talks about five stages of the inner journey that he likens to the stations of the cross. Those of you who are Catholic, and those of you who aren't, may know of the stations of the cross that depict the life of Jesus. And at each station you pause, say a prayer, you go on. It's a devotional form. He has five inner stations. And the first one is recognition. I'll write it on the board later. Resistance, acceptance, affirmation, and liberation. And I'll talk about each of them. The first step in this journey, the inner journey, is to recognize that life will pull you in different directions, that life is riddled with paradox. That's basically what I was talking about in the introduction. Recognizing the fact that you have to carry your cross, as Jesus admonished us, and that you have to learn to distinguish which crosses are valid and which crosses are masochistic things that you put on yourself and you say, I'm such a good Christian, I'm just going to do this. We want joy in our lives. So some crosses are unnecessary in the sense that we put them on ourselves. If we find joy in what we're doing, that's one of the touchstones that this cross we're carrying is a valid one. The pull between the divine and the earthly, between our aspirations and what we really can do, and as we get older, the acceptance of limitations. Because when we were young, we thought we could conquer the world. When we get to be my age, you begin to see that you're just not going to achieve everything you wanted in life. This acceptance is another recognition of the cross that you have to carry. And of course, the most difficult one is the recognition that there will be a time when your body will cease to be there and where you will be transformed into this other life that is promised to us as believers. That recognition is probably the biggest step in maturing, in a mature acceptance of death. All of us fear it, but finally we come to recognize it as the new birth, the beginning of the life that we're preparing for. Resistance to the cross is what we all know from the studies of Kubler-Ross, when she said that when you are faced with the death of a loved one or your own terminal illness, you say, no, no, and you start bargaining, you are angry, you're depressed, you resist it with all your might. And it's quite a struggle to reach an acceptance of this inevitable end to our earthly life. In therapy, we call this resistance negative transference. When you first go to the therapist is just wonderful. When the therapist begins to hold up unpleasant truths, or when it begins to hurt, you begin to experience a negative transference, and there is no end to what bad things you can say about the therapist. And then, again, you have to work through the resistance. Another example of resistance would be the way we don't like to face our own negative, our own shadow side. Shadow is a term that Carl Jung has coined, and I'll be talking a lot more about Jung. Carl Jung is the psychologist whom I follow, and I will talk about his psychology tomorrow. Anyhow, shadow side is the dark side in yourself that you can't face readily and that you resist and your stuff down. You say, no, I never lie, I never cheat, I never this. Most of us never do, but some of us have a dark side that maybe only our spouse knows about or a very, very close friend. And when they can accept you with all your faults, warts and all, then you know the person really loves you. He doesn't love just the beautiful side. So those dark sides have to be accepted, not just resisted, not just hidden. So we've talked a bit about recognizing the cross and about resisting the cross or the dark side. Then we come to acceptance. And acceptance, I will write this on the board so we can, if anybody else comes in later. Recognition, resistance, and towards the end I will have you share in small groups how these various stages, if any, have affected you in your own life. Acceptance, and then affirmation, saying yes to everything that you are, and liberation. Affirmation. In solitude, when you're alone, the task that you face is to live with all of yourself and to affirm those aspects of yourself that you have trouble affirming, and affirming that the aspects in other people that you have trouble affirming. Parker Palmer says that acceptance and affirmation go hand in hand, and these things don't follow one, two, three, but they're sort of go like this. You go through phases in these inner stations. Carl Jung talks of a spiral growth. We go over the same ground over and over again until we have solved the problem. And those of us who are a little older say, oh yes, I've been over this path before, but now I have a little more knowledge. Now I know how to solve this problem. When we come to sharing in small groups, I would like you to think about especially how you have come to acceptance and affirmation of those things that you cannot change. I'm reminded of the wonderful bit of wisdom that AA is based upon, namely, tell me what I can change, or show me what I can change, show me what I cannot change, let me know the difference. And affirmation includes some of that. You have to know what you can change in yourself, what you have to accept in yourself and in others. And as you have guessed from the last one, liberation follows after you have affirmed both yourself and others totally. When you have reached the acceptance of your dark side and affirmed the fact that you're okay, that you can face both the dark and the light in yourself and in others, then there's a sudden clarity, a liberation, a freedom, and this, I believe, is what Christ came to do for us, to set us free from bondage to sin, darkness, and to give us the assurance that we are forgiven, that we are made a new creation, but that we have to work at it as well. I think sometimes it's made to seem so easy, and as I said, we often look for cheap grace. Everything's forgiven, well, fine. We really have to work at this. You have to experience it in yourself, and then you're able to sing all day and really feel joyous most of the time. Nobody feels joyous all the time, but I'd say most of the time. There's a story that Parker Palmer has written about that I'd like to share with you. A man was in the habit of rising early. He was at a beach resort, at a resort by the ocean. And every morning he took a walk, and he saw that the people came and took the starfish that had been washed up on the shore and put them in barrels and or killed them. Anyhow, they did destroyed them. I don't know exactly why. One morning he got up even earlier and he saw a man who picked up the starfish, but instead of destroying and killing them, he threw them far out to sea, back into the light, so they could live. And he said, he called him the star thrower. It's a metaphor for saying yes to life and going to the trouble of picking up something as small as a starfish and returning them to the sea after they've been washed up. And sometimes when we're washed up in life, we need a friend who will be a star thrower for us. Now, if you'd like to pair off in threes around there, shall we count out, or would you just like to make threes, small groups of three? And for about 5 minutes, share with each other some aspect of your inner journey, mostly the problem of acceptance of some of the dark sides of life. How did I phrase this? What were some of the things that people shared? Does anybody feel up to sharing with the whole group? Some aspects that you talked about? Or would you rather leave it in small among yourselves? It's completely up to you. Yes?
Another gentleman in our group had an excellent example of how we can witness for Christ, but really, all we can do is witness, and the secret of our success lies within the person himself. Mm-hmm. He must make the commitment. We can't force our faith or force ourselves upon. We've done our job, but it's up to the Spirit of Christ to really make it happen. And I thought that was an excellent example.
Yes, thank you very much. Sometimes, especially with our children, we hope that we could make them see our way, and maybe sometimes they have to see their own way. We witness to them, and then they have to do their own finding, searching, questing, and finding. Thank you. Anyone else? Yeah.
I was sharing here that a big aha in my life, like in the last 2 weeks, has been that my father's an alcoholic. And I'm 30 years old, and I clearly recognized all these steps because I've known for years what an alcoholic is, but I've been resisting it. And I finally got around to recognizing it and accepting it, and that's been very liberating for me because now I know what direction I need to travel in to deal with my dad.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And have you been able to join a group like Al-Anon or?
This recognition is so new. I haven't had time to do that.
All right. What you bring up is the fact that when you name something and you recognize it, most of the fear and uncertainty goes away and perplexity. And as you said, you knew it for years. It happens to all of us. As I said, we just don't want to recognize the dark sides in ourselves or in others. Well, thank you for sharing. Anyone else? Yes.
In our group, we shared, all three of us, the idea of getting older and now is coming to retirement and accepting, recognizing that and not resisting it, but accepting it and retiring and go on and make a new life and enjoy that part of our life.
I can relate to that, thank you, because I have just retired a year ago from being a therapist and I found a wonderful new outlet working at a place called St. Martin's Table, at which Mary and John Schramm manage and help us form into a community. And it's totally different from what I did before. In fact, you wouldn't believe, but I do the cash register. And Charlie over there is one of the servers. We have volunteer servers, and all the tips go to a hunger project. And we send about $1,000 a year to a hunger project locally or abroad. So that's a whole new avenue. But it was hard to leave my profession, and it was difficult for my husband to leave off his teaching. He's also retired, and to find a new avenue. Now he writes poetry, and he says at last he has the leisure to spend the whole day putting in a comma and taking it out in the afternoon. That's his favorite. Anyone else would like to share? Yes, Nancy.
For me, one of the big problems for a long time has been the difference between intellectualizing and internalizing.
Mm-hmm.
I was married to an alcoholic, and it was very easy for me to apply these various things to him and also to read about them and to discuss them. But for me, actually, to internalize and make the commitment myself to deal with a lot of this was an entirely different process.
Mm-hmm.
And it took an enormous commitment to finally get through
some
of the real tough parts.
That's why in therapy, some of the resistance, the hardest resistance to get over is the intellectualizing that very bright analysands do. And those of us who want to become therapists are filled with theory, and we resist, we intellectualize. And from my own experience, when I first went into analysis, I said, yeah, well, Jung said, and then my analyst would just sort of sit there and look at him and say, when you finish intellectualizing, I'll listen to you. And experience is what Christ always asked us to do. He said, come and see. Come and experience. Don't just talk about something. Do it. Well, we have about 15, 20 minutes before we have to go into, before we start Vespers. Not have to. I enjoy Vespers. I'd like to talk briefly now about why Carl Jung thought dreams were so important, because on this inner journey, one of the ways...
Excuse me, Tom and I are going to be leading Vespers, but you listen to what I do at the beginning of Vespers. It's just amazing.
Really?
Yes.
Synchronicity. Should I talk about synchronicity now? All right. He knows me real well. Synchronicity is when a coincidence startles you because it is so unlikely that these two things should have happened together. And Jung coined the term synchronicity, and that means that it opens your eyes to a new connection. We know that everything is connected, but we don't usually see it because these things are in a realm, in a different realm. Depending on how mystically inclined you are, you will see more or less synchronicities. If you pay attention to your dreams, you will be amazed at the synchronicities that reveal themselves. You may be dreaming of someone and then meet them coming down the hall. Well, how come you came to Holden? Here at Holden, you probably make connections that are quite unusual. I don't have a good example. Do you, Erling, of synchronicity?
Well, none I could talk about in public.
All right. Okay. All right. I'll be talking about it more. This is one of the terms that Jung coined. Mostly a synchronicity is a little bit more than just a coincidence. It is not just lucky. It happens to reveal a connection, an inner connection. And the more the inner connection is true, the more energy is freed through the recognition of this occurrence.
What's the name of your sweatpants in Northfield? Remember you were...
All right, let's do that one.
She had worked through Weight Watchers and lost at least 20 pounds.
Yes.
And so she was looking for some appropriate sweatpants that would befit her new figure, which was an admirable goal. And we went down to Ragstock, was it?
Yeah.
Went down to downtown Northfield, as though that's such a big place. But we're there, and the one item that was for sale...
The one item that was for stock was
the exact pair of sweatpants that she bought.
Right.
And she came all the way to Northfield, and here it was, the exact pair you've been looking for.
That's right, exactly.
And they weren't available in Minneapolis or Burnsville or anywhere else.
That's a very mundane example, but it was very funny because we just finished talking about it, very casually, and I looked for sale. I'm sure you've all experienced it on a deeper level when things come together, and especially as answers to prayer. I have a great faith that we can ask And if we ask in faith, we will get an answer. We don't always get the answer we want, but it's yes, no, or maybe. You have to wait. It teaches us patience, teaches us that our will is not always the right will. And when I talk about dreams, I will say that, show you how dreams can help you see when you're going in the wrong direction. They're often a warning. And when you read this book, you will probably see that dreams in the Bible are the way God speaks to us through dreams, has spoken to us, and continues to speak to us through dreams. That does not mean that every time you have a dream, it's the voice of the Holy Spirit. Most dreams are just process, just processing what happened during the day. But some big dreams are indeed things you should pay attention to, and in the next sessions we'll talk about it. Carl Jung called dreams the royal road to the unconscious. And his unconscious is not just filled with sex and violence and death urges, as Freud said, but with wisdom, creativity, and energy that will lead you to this liberation. It will help you affirm the best in you and face and accept that which you can't change, or the dark side. The unconscious cannot be reached any other way. I like to use the example of the X-ray. Now, when you break your leg, you may not be sure if you broke it or if you sprained it. So you go to the hospital, the man X-rays it and says, yes, it's a hairline fracture, and tells you what to do. Without the X-ray, you wouldn't be sure that you had broken your leg. Without looking at your dreams, you can't see what's going on in the unconscious. You can't say, well, I'm going to meditate and really know what's going on, because your mind will screen it out. The dreams are just like X-rays or a mirror into the unconscious that cannot be known any other way. Though there are differing ways of interpreting dreams, but we'll get into that later too. Perhaps the most important thing to say here is that, according to Jung, the symbols in dreams are not fixed and not all sexual. They are, depending on the person, they vary and reveal more or less of his psyche, depending on how much effort the person puts into understanding the connections. And when you do this over a period of years, you begin to see like a red thread going through your dreams that tells you where you're supposed to be going or where you're supposed to be careful and what the different figures in your dreams represent. But we'll come to that in other sessions. I want to stress one more paradox. When you came up to Holden, I don't know what your expectations were, but when we come into community, we can lose ourselves and forget to find the solitude and the quiet that we can find simply by taking a walk or hike or sitting and meditating for a few minutes. And I think it's very important to recognize the pull. To be totally in community can make you lose yourself. If you pull away too much, you don't get the benefit of the richness of all the people that are here. So when I first came to Holden, I participated in every single presentation, and I gradually realized that I was exhausted. So then I went the other way, and I only came to Vespers. Then I lost all the good things. So find a happy balance. I'd like to show you a picture of Carl Jung. Maybe you can pass it around. Look at one side and the other. Here is the scholar, and here is the man who sits and ponders. He actually looks like a farmer. You could just pass that around. What Carl Jung did was write 17 volumes on psychology and psychoanalysis, but he also was a stone carver, a cook, and he worked with his hands, and he balanced his life, inner and outer, as probably no other man has done. History's coming into his own quite a bit now. I will talk about Carl Jung tomorrow and invite you all to come back at that time. Any questions? Things you'd like me to talk about? You're asking whether Carl Jung came to this early or later. I think it was in middle life, after he had started his private practice. He worked in a hospital and trained in a hospital first, and then built his tower in Küsnacht in Switzerland and started carving the stone, in the stone, all the things he wanted to remain for posterity. One of which is a Latin saying, vocatus atque non vocatus Deus ad erit, which means whether you call on God or do not call on God, God is always there. Another paradox. In other words, God doesn't move, we move. God doesn't change, we change. Yes, he came to it in later life, I would say, middle, late life.
I was thinking about his development, the development of his types, and understanding of the types and balance.
Yes. Tomorrow I'll talk about types. You've all heard of extroversion and introversion. That's a term coined by Jung. But he also has four functions that are in the form of a cross. And I might as well put it on the board now and you can begin to think about it. And I'll just do one example here. This could be thinking, then the opposite is feeling, and I'll define all this tomorrow. Then on this side is sensation, or the sensate, or this practical, and here the intuition. And these opposites pull in opposite directions and need to be reconciled. We'll talk about that. And you can be an extroverted thinker or an introverted thinker. You could be an extroverted intuitive or an introverted intuitive, and so forth. I'll explain that tomorrow. Any other questions?
In your dreams, the only problem I have with dreams, and I dream often, is that when I start to recite them or even start to think them, I lose the continuity of them, and all of a sudden it's gone, and I can't put it in language, because it's not there. It was so real, and so it was just wow.
Wow.
I wake up and I can't say it, and when I start to say it, it just disappears. It melts away.
All right. We've all had that experience. I have often, even though I've kept my dreams for over 30 years. One of the best ways to keep it from evaporating is to keep your eyes closed for whatever time it takes for it to solidify, so that you recite it to yourself before you recite it to someone else or write it down. And better than telling the dream is writing it down. It won't evaporate as fast. Yes?
I have another experience along that same line. Don't give up.
Yes.
Because it seems to evaporate, because it's still there.
Yeah.
Hold on. And sometimes it'll come. That
right.
That's been my experience. It'll come back.
For me, yeah, that happens to me quite often. Most of all, keeping your eyes closed so that you have no other stimuli, because it's there. And also, I want to say that we all dream about 4 or 5 times a night when we have the rapid eye movements, and that the material is there. And the function of dreams is to keep you sane. But the other function is to give you wisdom and warning and joy.
And why do some of us not remember them?
Probably don't need to remember them or don't want to remember them. And I'm not making a judgment.
No,
I just that if you set yourself to remember the dream, it will come. But if you don't, if you're pretty busy and well-adjusted and in no crisis, you probably don't need to remember your dreams. And if you want to, you will set yourself to try to remember them. Yeah.
A little different. I mean, you've anchored yourself in Jung, and I find that admirable, because one thing that is bombards us all the time, especially in America, is this pop psychology advice that we get from all kinds of different, you know, different sources all over the place, magazines and journals, and Dr. Ruth, and for those who are people. And what do you think of that? But anyway. And is it, I mean, would you recommend, you know, trying to find one position that you find more compatible, or else, you know, staying with this smorgasbord kind of thing, that you know, a little astrology, a little machine,
Well, you know me well enough to know that I'd prefer to stay with one outlook, but I would not disregard reputable advice givers. I don't know if Ann Landers fits that, but I do read her every morning. And I have chosen a follower of Jung rather than a Jungian, because I had a Jungian, an analyst who was a follower of Jung, but he has worked with Freud and taken a lot from Freud, and there's a lot that Adler and all the other analysts can contribute, Karen Horney and others. I'll mention all those tomorrow. They all help, but when you become a professional, you have to make a decision, and so I chose to be a follower of Jung. There was another question there. Yes.
What amazes me so about dreams is that your mental picture is so clear in your mind, and your sensations, your feelings, and everything are so clear and well defined. And I've often wondered about that.
And what is the question? You've wondered why they are so clear?
Yeah, why?
I don't really know why they are so clear, but thank God they are.
Why are they such a jumble? Mine are often such a jumble.
Yeah, that varies. You may be visually, have a very visual sense. I don't know. Some people ask me whether they always dream in color or whether it's all black and white. I think that's a personal thing. Some people have very intricate, complex, story-type dreams. Others just have an image. The clarity speaks well for easy remembering, I suppose. Oh, yes. I've had a few friends tell me that that's what they like to do. And unfortunately, I'm very unmechanical. I bet I pushed the wrong button, right? But that's a very good way. Anyone else? We should wind up the session. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Thank you all.